The Dharma, in contravene profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands and millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. What you just witnessed is an example of how our Zen practice should function, that we can respond to circumstances without having a problem around it. Today is day 6 of this session, this very special session here at Mountain Gate in December 2017, the Rohatsu session, the session that commemorates Siddhartha Gautama's awakening, which resulted in his appellation, the Buddha, being the name we call him by mostly these days, Buddha, literally meaning awake. It's nothing special. He's not a god. He's not anything other than an ordinary human being who was so caught in concern, having encountered a sick person, a corpse, an old person, and then finally, with hope, a spiritual practitioner. At a time when he was young and had never, ever experienced such a thing before, that it shocked the heck out of him and touched some deep root of longing within, so that he left and went to the jungle to do ascetic practices for the next 6 years until he got to the point of near death, which point he realized that if he didn't do things differently, he was simply going to die without finding an answer to why do these things happen? Why is there suffering in the world? Is this all we're going to know? We're born and we may have some moments of pleasure and moments of pain. We get sick, we get old, and we die. Is that it? Isn't there something more? And he found his answer. And not only did he find his answer, but he found it in such a profound depth and with such clarity that he was able to share that understanding and the way to reach it within each one of us with countless people after that. And really his message comes down the generations through each of the different generations of people who took his instructions to heart and awakened themselves and then taught further generations how to do it as well. Again, this was just an ordinary human being, just as we are ordinary human beings, and our potential is no different from his. We too can come to deep awakening and experience the joy and the freedom and the clarity in our life that he experienced from then on, so that no matter what happens in our life, and we're at a rather critical point in history right now with a lot of strife in the world, most recently President Trump allowed the every 6 month injunctions against Congress's, when was it, 2016, or at some point, Congress decided that they would move on counting Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It had been Tel Aviv, or is still Tel Aviv, well, it's not still Tel Aviv because now it's supposed to be Jerusalem and the embassy, American embassy, is supposed to be going to move there. But this has created an enormous amount of anger in the Muslim world, and for good reason. I think of a comparable situation in India. Bodh Gaya is known as the place where the Buddha became the Buddha. Sitting under the Bodh tree, which I think it's a granddaughter tree at this point, still exists. You can sit under that Bodh tree on that ground where Siddhartha Gautama sat, and Duzasan yourself. There's a monument there, but the challenge is that it's not just considered a holy place or a special place by Buddhists, it's also considered a special place by Hindus. And there's a constant tug of war over the location and periodic strife. Why they can't just agree and get along and share the location that is deemed special to both the cultures is beyond my understanding, at least. And the same is true of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is also a city, an ancient city that is revered. There are places that are revered not just by Jews, but also by Arabs of different subcultures. And in making this move to declare it the capital of Israel, a Jewish state, is pouring oil on a fire there. And the Arab world leaders have responded with sometimes more than concern. And the very basis of at least the concern of some of them is that it vastly inhibits any peace efforts for the area. Israel was created after the Second World War as a place for refugee Jews who'd been cast out of the countries they had lived in for centuries to go and have their own promised land once more. And in order for that to happen, it was carved out of Palestine. And there's been no end of anguish on the part of the Palestinian people about that. And we're talking about a part of the world where emotions run strong and deep. And we've just seen, as I said, oil poured on a fire there. But there's difficulty everywhere in the world. In the United States, it looks like there's a tax bill that's going to be come law. It's passed both the House and the Senate. And it favors, in large part, big corporations and very wealthy people at the expense of the people who have very little money or people have only a little bit of money. It yanks healthcare away from people. Recently, I saw a notice that more women than ever are entering public office now. And one of the profiles was of a young woman who's a doctor, a medical doctor. She's a pediatric, I don't know whether it's a neurosurgeon or a neurologist. And she said that when she looked into the eyes of a young patient with a brain tumor, whose parents had only recently been able, thanks to Obamacare, been able to get health insurance, which would make it possible for this child to survive. And knowing that the estimate is 13 million people will be without health insurance as a result of this, what's been going on in the Congress these days. Somehow compassion has flown out the window, generosity has flown out the window, and it's me first and you can just deal with it. And I'm going to keep my money and I don't care whether you don't have any. It's really not a very healthy time in American politics. And of course in the world, violence is everywhere. They just found out about a plot early enough to murder the British top person, blowing up the gates at 10 Downing Street, proposed suicide mission that they were able to stop because they learned about it early enough. people seem to be willing to destroy their own bodies in order to create pain and suffering for other people. It is quite boggling. And it underscores how vital it is for those of us who are drawn to practice to seriously deepen our own awareness, to reach deep within, to come to awakening as the Buddha did. Not a superficial awakening. There are plenty of those. And it'll be nice for a while. But then the old habit patterns come rolling back. What we're talking about here is the urgent need to go profoundly deep and come to profound awakening. And then, and this will be addressed in a few minutes as well, transform our lives, letting go of greed, anger, and delusion, seeing through our habit patterns of conditioning. The Buddha rightly recognized that people are products of conditioning, and that conditioning causes us to react to people and situations in ways that wouldn't make sense if one knew the clear story. We're coming out of our conditioning, our assumptions about ourselves and about others. And it's a recipe for pain and suffering. But before we do that, as is traditional in Rahatsu Sesshin, in the Rinzai sect, we will share the Rahatsu exhortations for day 6 of Zen Master Hakuin. This is the 6th night. An attendant brought a cup of tea for the master, and he said, when Zen Master Yosai, founder of Kenninji, was in China, he took ill during a spell of excessive heat. An old priest cured him by giving him some tea to drink. When Yosai returned to Japan, he took tea seeds back with him for the palace in Kyoto. By the way, that was illegal. He had to smuggle them in. Some seeds were later planted in Uji, and some went to Myo-e Shonin, who planted them at his temple west of the capital. Because of this, Yosai is regarded as the father of tea in Japan. The virtue of tea lies in its mildly bitter taste, which works to strengthen the heart. When the heart is sound, the other bodily organs also function normally. Myo-e said, tea is good for driving off the sleep demon and should be used by those practicing the way. This is why it is so popular. Green tea is what we're talking about here in Zen temples, basically ever since that point in time. You drink green tea, it's not the same as coffee. Normally, you get a nice, mild lift that lasts for a long time and lets you down gently, and enables you to do more focused practice, really. It sharpens our minds, and it helps us stay awake for the long hours of yaza, the late night sitting. So it's particularly beneficial during sesshin. This is probably why Hakuin talked about it. When it comes to strengthening the heart, however, nothing can compare to strenuous religious practice. If you devote yourself to your practice single-mindedly until your arduous effort becomes one with your very being, the divine energy that is within you will shine forth bright and clear. As Zen Master Jimyo said, the arduous effort expended by the ancients possess a radiance that cannot help but spread and grow. Jimyo was the Chinese monk. Jimyo is his the Japanese pronunciation of his the characters of his name in Chinese. Jimyo was famous. He was particularly famous for Hakuin because Hakuin became extraordinarily discouraged in his practice at a point. he had joined practice, Hakuin had, because he was a scared kid. He was sure he was going into hell for some of the boyish things he'd done, and like taking pot shots at blackbirds and killing some of them, and some other things that were not really that big a deal in a certain way, but he was a very sensitive kid. And so he was sure he was going to hell. And then when his mother took him to a lecture by, I think it was a Nichiren priest, when he was about 10 or 11 years old, and the priest was talking about the hell realms and how one false step and you're going to plunge right into the boiling oil that's tended by the devils, or be skewered in the sword tree hell, or freeze to death in the ice hell, and all kinds of things like that. There's a whole glorious set of descriptions of the hells that one could fall into. And these hells really are in our own mind. They're not somewhere else. But Hakuin desperately lived to avoid hell. And so he finally was able to convince his parents when he was 14 to allow him to become a Buddhist monk, because he had gotten the impression from yet another talk, I think it was a play actually, in which a Buddhist monk was accused of something or other and consigned to death, and a red-hot iron pot was placed on his head, and he just stood there coolly, calmly, and collected without it apparently burning him at all. And Hakuin took hope in that and decided that if he became a Buddhist monk, perhaps he could escape the hell he was otherwise, he was convinced, destined for. But then when he was something like 19 years old, he heard that Ganto, who was a very famous, deeply realized Chinese master, screamed when he was murdered by bandits that came to his temple. And he thought to himself, how could somebody that deeply awakened be in such pain and such agony that they would scream as they were being killed? How could it happen that they were being killed, period? Wouldn't they, being a Buddhist monk, live a fine, gentle, long life? And he became hugely discouraged. And he was sort of wandering around trying to figure out what to do, and ended up in a temple where they were, they had springtime, so they were airing the scrolls in the sun in order to keep them from being mildewed, and also to keep the bugs from nesting in them. And so he decided that he would close his eyes and point his finger, grab one of the scrolls, close his eyes, pointed finger, and go by whatever statement his finger had landed on. And so he closed his eyes and opened it up and pointed, opened his eyes and came to a statement about great effort, and the story of Jimyo, who was so committed to deepening his practice, regardless of how sleepy he was. The held an awl, and awl is not really used much anymore these days. We have drills for the purpose, but an awl is a pointed instrument that's used to make holes. And he held an awl at his thigh, so that if he started to fall asleep, he'd jab himself and wake himself up. There's actually a traditional piece of equipment that is given to Rinzai Zen masters, and that is it's a long flat stick with a sort of cupped opening in the top, or the top end is sort of cupped with two points, and hold it in your lap, so that if you start to fall asleep, these points jab you under the chin and wake you up. As all kinds of means that people of old have taken to try to stay awake, to deepen their practice. So, when it comes to strengthening the heart, however, nothing can compare to strenuous religious practice. If you devote yourself to your practice single-mindedly, until your arduous effort becomes one with your very being, you're not striving to apply something to get a result. You're allowing your awareness, total awareness, to drop deep, 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 deep down, searching within for what will free you. And you don't know what that is, but there is something that brought you to practice. And you allow that to function, to bring you deep. And you persist and persist and persist long enough. And what happens is you forget yourself in the search. And when you forget yourself, that's when awakening can happen. It cannot happen when you're applying something from the outside. As Zen Master Jinryo said, the arduous effort expended by the ancients possesses radiance that cannot help but spread and grow. Spurring students through the barriers, says, that was the book that he and the Hakuin opened up to. When you are able to control your mind at all times, your goal of realization is as good as achieved. Now, control your mind. What does that really mean? It doesn't mean to force it into a way of thinking. It means to let go your ideas about yourself in particular and things in general, so that you can be open to comprehending the deep truth that lies everywhere. You should all deem the arduous effort you put forth in your practice as something of priceless worth. There was a priest named Bunmei from the northern provinces who wanted to come to Shoinji. Shoinji, of course, was Hakuin's family temple that he inherited and which still functions today. He tried in various ways for over 6 years to gain permission to study here. I told him, to me, it doesn't matter how great and celebrated a priest is. He could have a purple robe from the emperor, for all I care. If his dharma eye remains unopened, as far as I'm concerned, he's still a novice. He still needs a heavy dose of scolding and reviling. We don't teach in that way anymore. Perhaps it was appropriate and worked in the Japanese culture of Hakuin's time. But there are more appropriate ways to help a person be guided in a direction that will be optimal for finding truth. Anyone who harbors as much as a thought for the world or the slightest feeling of self-importance couldn't derive any benefit from visiting me. And it's that self-importance that is what we seek to let go of. And we can't let go of it by deciding to let go of it. We let go of it by dropping beneath our ideas about ourselves. And as we do that, we become more clear of the truth and see the falsity of some of these ideas that we have about ourselves. And when we see the falsity, they lose their importance. We cease being interested in living in the way derived by them or defined by them. Bunmei wouldn't give up. I'm no different from a novice, he said. Someone newly arrived in the training hall intent solely on achieving the great Dharma. Please, Master Hakuin, don't begrudge me your compassion. Give me the benefit of your teaching. Let me encounter your thundering shouts. Feel the stinging blows rain from your staff. I'm prepared to lay down my life in pursuit of the way. And really, it is our life, or our, what we think is our life, our life image, our self-image, that we have to lay down in pursuit of the way. And it doesn't go easily. I allowed Bumi to come. He spent one summer, 3 months of arduous practice in the training hall, where he was tempered and refined under countless blows from my staff. Finally, he broke through, and he suddenly realized the great uplifting matter of our school. He vowed when he left that he would remain my student forever. A spirit of single-minded commitment and iron-willed resolve cannot rest until it reaches the final, ultimate attainment of the Buddha's Dharma. And now I'd like to share something that may or may not seem what you would hear in a Buddhist teisho. This is from Rumi. It's from a collection called Say I Am You, translated by John Moyne and Coleman Barks. Coleman Barks is an excellent translator of Rumi. The title is Be Suspicious of Yourself. That's a really good teisho right there. Be suspicious of yourself, of who you think you are, of your reactions to things, of your assumptions about others as well. Everything you do has a quality which comes back to you in some way. That's karma. Every action takes a form in the invisible world, which may be different from how you thought it would appear. A crime is committed and gallows begin to be built. One does not look like the other, but they correspond. Accept the results of what you've done in anger or for greed or to elevate your ego. Don't blame fate. That dog lies in the kennel and will not respond to anyone's calling. Be suspicious of yourself. Inquire about your hidden motives. It takes courage to repent and more courage to change. But realize this, just as dust grains shine in sunlight coming through this window, so there's a light of reality within which ideas, hidden hypocrisies, and the qualities of every action become clear. All you've done and will do will be seen in the light of that sun. It is said that in the moments of our death, our life plays back in slow motion, and we see with greater clarity than ever we have our behavior throughout the extent of our life. And for some people, there are deep regrets when that happens. This points to what Hakuin's student and Dharma successor Torii Enji called the long maturation, which is a vital aspect of our practice. And why are we bringing this up on day 6 of Sesshin, aside from the fact that Hakuin makes reference to it? It's because we are now so much more clear, having done all these hours of Zazen, that sometimes our behavior, our habit patterns, really, and here we are not casting blame. It's important to recognize this. We all have a measure of conditioning, and that conditioning produces assumptions about ourselves and about others. And those assumptions about ourselves and about others cause us to react to things out of a kind of a skewed self-image. The Buddha himself said that conditioning is what causes people grief. And so it is. We act in ways that, if we were clear, we'd be horrified by sometimes, or at least dismayed by. And our practice, although it can be painful until we recognize the incredible benefits of it, can be challenging, because if we do our practice appropriately and become more clear, we also become more clear about where we're caught and what our habit patterns are. And we may see ourselves behaving in ways that we really would not want to have behaved, but we're unconscious about, because we simply were reacting out of our conditioning. And the long maturation is about not just seeing these, but as part of that seeing, letting them go. There are a couple of Zen sayings that speak to this. One of them is, watch your footsteps. As we go along interacting, it's important to reach deep within and sense as clearly as possible what's pulling our strings as we react to a situation. Is this from a place of clarity, or is this from some conditioning? Did we understand that situation clearly, or was it skewed by our assumptions about ourselves and about others? Watch your footsteps. Whatever we do, whenever we do, even our thoughts, go deep within and do a reality check, like some of the news agencies do these days. Check it out. Where are we really coming from? Of course, we can have a lot of rationalization, but we're talking about dropping beneath rationalization. And it can be a challenging experience or a series of experiences until we recognize that this is how we become free. That when we see clearly that we have behaved in a particular way, caught in some misunderstanding of ourselves or a situation, that when we realize that, that the next time we are tempted to react in the same way under similar circumstances, it's almost as if some invisible stop sign comes up and says, wait a minute, do you really want to do that again? And we have the option very easily and very readily to say, no, I would prefer the clarity, thank you. And in this way, we become little by little more free and more able to allow our innate compassion and wisdom to function without the hindrance of conditioning. This is a vital part of Zen practice. Without it, our practice really is meaningful. The other is, the Bodhisattva leaves no traces. And in a certain way, it's similar. It is said, when the birds fly through the air, they don't leave traces in the air. And our behavior, ideally, is the same. When we behave in a clear, uncaught way, then there are no traces. It's seamless. And again, I have to emphasize, this is not about blame. This is not about accusations. This is about a teaching that will help each one of us become more free. And there's no exception here with the one that's speaking. It's an amazing, incredibly effective, challenging, wondrous practice that we've committed to by being here in this sesshin, by sitting again and again and again when we're tired, when we're crabby, when we're wanting to be anywhere else and do anything else, but something deep is drawing us. A true felt need for liberation that is real, authentic, and lasting. And the Zazen will bring us to awareness, but then we need to take that awareness and work with it and use it as the tool it is to let go these habit patterns, all these places where we're caught in a false identity. Who are we really? This is a fundamental question. Who are we really? It's not this bundle of experiences, conditioning. What is the fundamental truth of our existence? This is the very core of our practice. So in these last hours of Sesshin, and tomorrow night we'll be sitting all night long, give yourselves even more fully to it, because all the work you've done up through this day, up through tomorrow night, will give you strength and clarity to continue going deeper and to become even more let go, so that the benefits of having come to the Sesshin will be true benefits, and the possibility of them lasting, and the transformation of your life in beautiful, free ways will be realized. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.